Imagine waking up on a hotel room floor, the city's sounds muffled by the walls, with the stark realization that you have no memory of who you are or how you got there. This is the opening scene of Amnesia, a text adventure that transcended traditional gaming to become quite a unique narrative journey. Released in 1986, Amnesia is not just a game, it's an intricate story penned by the acclaimed author Thomas M. Dish, blurring the lines between a novel and interactive fiction. With every command typed, players would unravel a mystery of a meticulously detailed New York City, making choices that could either lead to the recovery of their identity or deeper into the web of forgetfulness. Today, we're going to dive deep into the heart of Amnesia, exploring this intersection of prose and pixel, where each decision paints a stroke in the grand canvas of storytelling. So join us today as we discover what it's like to forget on yet another trip down memory card lane. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. I hope these words find you well. Hello and welcome to the 189th episode of our video game history podcast, A Trip Down Memory Card Lane. Each week, we'll tell you a story relevant to the current week in gaming history. It can be about a game or the people that created it. It can be about a console or the technology that brought it to life. We often talk about the companies that bring it all together, making our hobby a reality. While telling you each story, we hope to teach you something new about the topic, what it took from the world as its inspiration, or what it gave back to the world in its legacy. Today, we're diving into the world of Amnesia, a game that broke the mold by blending interactive fiction with a narrative depth rarely seen at its time. Released in 1986, this text adventure game took players on a thrilling journey through a meticulously detailed New York City, all from the perspective of a protagonist with no memory. I'm David Kasten, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, who's more likely to forget his keys than his name. But today, he's the one guiding us through the streets of New York. It's my brother, Rob Kasten. Rob, have you ever forgotten where you were in the middle of New York City?
So easy to forget where you never were.
Yeah, exactly. But there's a version of New York City in some video game, isn't there? Spider-Man.
Yeah, you got me there. I did. I definitely got lost a lot in that game. But, you know, it's not the same.
No, it's not the same. It's definitely not the same. All right. Well, one thing that you don't forget, you know, because I'm kind enough to put it right in front of you. What's going on in the current week in gaming history?
Well, Dave, on April 7th, 1986, the gaming world welcomed Atlus into its fold. Founded in Tokyo, Japan, Atlus quickly established itself as a beacon of creativity and innovation in the industry. Known for its deeply narrative-driven games and a penchant for the eccentric, Atlus has gifted gamers with series that have transcended the boundaries of traditional gaming genres. From the dark, twisted corridors of the Shin Megami Tensei series to the heartwarming, time-bending adventures in Persona, Atlus has a knack for creating worlds that are as rich in character as they are in challenge.
True statement. We've done episodes on Shin Megami Tensei. Have we done Persona yet? I don't think we have.
I don't believe we have, but that means it's coming up.
It is coming up. I know I have it on a list. I think it's coming up later this year, but we definitely did a Shin Megami episode. You all should go check it out.
Right you are, Dave. And as we continue our voyage through the significant week in gaming history, we find ourselves revisiting a moment that marked the resurgence of the classic first-person shooter genre. It was on April 12, 2004, gamers were introduced to Painkiller, a game that would reinvigorate the fast-paced, adrenaline-pumping action that fans of the genre craved. Painkiller set itself apart with its relentless action, intricate level design, and an arsenal of weapons that were as inventive as they were devastating. Garnering critical acclaim and a loyal following, Painkiller spawned several expansions and sequels, cementing its place in the hearts of gamers who long for the pure, unadulterated action of the genre's early days.
I legit own like 3 Painkiller games in box, like physical form. So, you know, when it came out, it was just that. It was like, it was modern, but it was revisiting like Doom, like the beginning of everything, you know?
Absolutely. It was a game that I've played once or twice. I didn't happen to get too into it, but I do recall. And, you know, it's good that it reinvigorated that awesome feel.
Very true.
So, Dave, continuing our expedition through this memorable week in gaming history, we commemorate the anniversary of a game that masterfully blended martial arts action with deep role-playing elements. Set against the backdrop of a richly imagined world inspired by ancient Chinese mythology.
What's that?
On April 12, 2005, Jade Empire was released, inviting players on an epic journey through the mythical lands of the Jade Empire, where martial arts mastery was the key to unraveling a complex story of power, betrayal, and honor. Developed by BioWare, a studio renowned for narrative-driven games, Jade Empire offered players an immersive experience filled with dynamic combat, moral choices, and a cast of memorable characters. Jade Empire stood out for its ambitious attempt to fuse action and RPG elements within a setting seldom explored in video games.
We talked about Jade Empire, didn't we?
It sounds super familiar, but I don't remember it by name. So, you know, you're asking the wrong person as always.
Yeah, we talked about it in our BioWare episode, which we've covered BioWare a few times over. So, Jade Empire was, I mean, it was like their first attempt at an open world game. They had done, you know, other people's IPs up until that point, and that was something they had wanted to do since the beginning, and Jade Empire was their first attempt. Mass Effect would have been the episode we talked about it the most, so check that one out.
I definitely remember Mass Effect. Rounding out our journey through the current week in gaming history, we arrive at a pivotal moment that reshaped the landscape of post-apocalyptic gaming. On April 9th, 2007, a transaction took place that would forever alter the destiny of one of the most iconic franchises in the gaming world. Fallout.
Ooh.
It was on April 9th, 2007, that Interplay, the original creator of the Fallout series, sold the rights to the franchise to Bethesda Softworks. This move not only signaled a new chapter for the Fallout series, but also marked the beginning of an era that would see the franchise ascend to new heights of popularity and critical acclaim.
And coincidentally, the day this episode publishes, the Fallout television series releases on Amazon Prime, and reviews have come in the past couple days, and they have been great. Apparently, it is incredibly authentic to the source material, and it feels more like an addition to the series, like more stories told in the same universe than trying to like adopt the video games in any way, shape, or form. But they apparently have done a really great job of universe building, so go check it out.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, go check that out. Woo!
Woo!
All right, so Thomas Dish was born in Des Moines, Iowa in 1940. But in Iowa, in the mid-40s, there was a polio epidemic, so he was largely homeschooled through his early years. Eventually, his family moved to St. Paul, Minnesota, where he would attend public school and Catholic school. In public schools, he discovered a lifelong love for science fiction, for drama, for poetry. Basically, found the writing bug when he was here in secondary schools in Minnesota. After graduating high school, he worked a summer job as a trainee steel draftsman, where he saved up enough money to move to New York City at the ripe old age of 17. Can you imagine moving to that big of a city at 17?
I cannot. No, that seems insane to me.
Yeah, same. That's pretty crazy.
I mean, it's bigger than any city. I've never been there, and I mean, I don't think Chicago is quite the same population. So, I don't do well with those kind of crowds.
In New York City, he found work at a bookstore, then at a newspaper. He also worked as an extra at the Metropolitan Opera House and various Met productions. But still, he couldn't make ends meet. And at the age of 18, he was broke, penniless, no prospects, and so he attempted suicide. I say attempted because he tried to stick his head inside a gas oven, but he forgot to remember that he couldn't afford to pay the gas bill.
Oh, no.
So you know, no suicide.
Oh, man.
Isn't that the worst story? Like, that's
sad, and then it's even more sad. Like, damn.
I know. I failed at failing. So, he decided that he was going to be an army man, but he didn't like the army. So, he ended up discharged from the army, lost his mind, was committed to a mental hospital for 3 months. He was discharged and returned to New York, where he found work again in bookstores, later as a copywriter. Eventually, he got a job with an insurance company and decided to go back to school. He had caught the architecture bug. I mean, you're in New York. Where else do you capture the architecture bug, you know? So he applied to Cooper Union, supposedly got the highest score ever at the time for their entrance exam, but then quit school after a few weeks of classwork. So he decided he was going to go to night classes at New York University, NYU, where he took classes on novella writing and utopian fiction. Back to the writing bug. Man loves writing. Thomas Dish loves writing. So in May of 1962, he decides to write a short story instead of studying for the midterms. That story, called The Double Timer, sold to a magazine called Fantastic for $112.50.
Wow.
I know, right? And that, to Thomas Dish, was the start of his literary career. So he never went back to NYU. Never finished those midterms. Instead, he took a number of odd jobs. He was a bank teller. He was a mortuary assistant. He was a copy editor. These were all jobs he took in order to support what he called his nighttime writing habit.
I'm just shocked at that amount for a magazine. I feel like it would just, like, maybe I don't know enough about Fantastic, but I just feel like magazines wouldn't pay as much for first time.
I agree, especially not 1962. So no wonder he thought he was
destined to write it.
Yeah, right.
Man, that's awesome, though.
So Thomas Dish actually entered the field of science fiction at really a pivotal moment for the genre, right? It was in the mid-60s, early to mid-60s, when science fiction was evolving from these campy, cheesy, small pulp adventure stories into, like, longer, more serious, and darker science fiction, right? And he definitely wrote the latter. And so, like, he came into the genre at the perfect time for his writing style and themes and concept and so on and so forth. His first novel was called The Genocides. It was written in 1965. It described the genocide of humans by aliens who seed the planet Earth with enormous plants. So basically these gigantic plants get planted by aliens and they start overgrowing everything and taking over the Earth and like murdering humans, because once the alien plants have taken over Earth, like our plants can't grow and we start to die. So it's kind of a genius genocide, honestly.
Yeah, that's really smart. Holy crap.
Right?
Scary.
In 1972, he wrote a dystopian science fiction novel called 334. It took place in New York in the year 2025. Funny, because here we are. And it depicted a future marked by limited technological advancements, overpopulation, and stark class divisions. No joke. Overpopulation has made housing scarce. A welfare state was developed to help those in need, but it has resulted in extreme class division between welfare recipients and professionals who don't need welfare.
Yeah, that hurts. Yeah. Ooh, yeah. That was so. You know, some of these writers, you really think can see into the future, because holy crap.
Yeah, it's just funny. Like, I'm like, 2025, scarce housing, welfare state. Yikes. Thomas Dish wrote novels over a lifetime of work. He wrote short stories. He wrote novellas. He wrote poetry. He wrote nonfiction. Literally in the early 2000s, he wrote a book on, on like why science fiction is important type deal. Like he wrote everything. He dabbled everywhere. He even dabbled in writing children's books. You probably know his most famous, what I would argue is his most famous book ever. It was called The Brave Little Toaster, A Bedtime Story for Small Appliances.
I fucking love The Brave Little Toaster. That is fantastic. Yes.
Later on, he sold the rights to that book to Disney, which resulted in the 1987 film, The Brave Little Toaster.
Oh, I love that movie growing up. Oh, so good.
So you know Thomas Dish. You may not know his science fiction, but you probably know Thomas Dish if you grew up as a Disney kid at any point, because The Brave Little Toaster is, you know, one of their movies. So
that's awesome.
But you may be asking yourself at this moment, Dave, why are we learning about the guy who wrote about The Brave Little Toaster? What does that have to do with video games?
It should have spawned a video game is what it's meant to be, damn it.
I don't think there is a Brave Little Toaster video game.
I know, there should have been.
I know. I'm going to get to that in a moment. But first, I'd like to tell you all about the all-in-one podcasting suite of tools that makes it easier than ever to create your own podcast, but brought to you by our friends at Zencastr. So do you want to make your own podcast? Do you have something clever and engrossing that you'd like to share with the world? Come check out this all-in-one podcasting suite of tools that makes it easier than ever to create your own podcast.
With Zencastr, it's super easy to record a podcast. Everyone logs in using their web browser, and you just start recording a high-quality podcast right away. It allows you to record up to 4K video with your guests. And with Zencastr's multi-layered backups, you always have the highest quality recordings, even if the connection is unstable.
And with Zencastr, you never have to worry about what you sound like. Zencastr's post-production process makes you sound buttery smooth. It automatically removes all those ums and ahs, removes all those awkward pauses in conversation, too. You can set the right podcast loudness, you can reduce background noise, you can do it all. It's just a bunch of menu options, and then you click a button and let it go.
And if the thought of podcasting overwhelms you because you think you need tons of different tools and services, relax. Those days are over. With Zencastr's all-in-one podcasting platform, you can create your podcast all in one place and distribute it to Spotify, Apple, and other major destinations.
So if you'd like to start your own podcast, or maybe you want to take your current one to the next level, we've got a deal for you. Go to Zencastr.com/pricing and use our offer code MemoryCardLane. you'll get 30% off the first month of any of their paid plans.
Sign up for Zencastr today, and you can experience the same ease in producing your own high-quality podcast as we do each week. Go out and share your ideas with the world.
Yeah. All right, so back to Thomas Dish and video games. So back in episode 177, Rob, we talked about Zork, right? One of the greatest and most influential text adventures of all time.
Got that right.
Zork was cool. Zork was a great game. You know, it's interesting because Zork had like playtesters who helped influence it. So it's a really interesting story. I would highly recommend going to check that out if you haven't. Zork was made by a company called Infocom. And Infocom was very, very good at text adventures. And they were very successful at it for, I say, quite some time, about a decade. You know, they founded in like 79, 1980. Zork original was 77, and they found a little bit after that. So, and they existed through the 80s, you know, were bought out by the end of it. So they were really good at text adventures until they weren't, to be honest with you. You know, they made text games through the entire 80s. But the truth of the matter is that by roughly about 1982, the video game market was already moving on to graphic adventure games, right? Because that's when the Atari was out and arcades were out. And we know that the video game market crashed in 83. But, you know, it was largely in response to these home consoles like the Atari 2600, you know, that had produced all these graphic games. And so the industry as a whole was moving on to graphics, right?
Right.
As we talked about in the episode, those game designers at Infocom, they were text writers. They were against using graphics. They did not want to make graphic adventure games. They wanted to stick with what they know. And anytime they tried to partner up with another company to do the graphics, for one reason or another, you know, timing wasn't right, the tools didn't work together, all these partnerships that were suggested, they all kind of failed. So in result of that, Infocom came up with a brilliant solution that worked in their favor for a short while. And what they did was their marketing department pushed out a series of advertisements that mocked graphical games as graffiti when compared to the human imagination. You know, you computer graphics can't nearly be as good as what you picture in your brain. So graphic adventure games are trash. That was essentially what the campaign was. And it was a very, very, very successful campaign. For a brief moment, I mean, it didn't last forever, obviously, but for a brief moment, it led to an uptick in sales of their text adventures, and it led to the public clamoring for more text adventures. And so other companies started to take notice, right? Companies like Broderbund and companies like Electronic Arts. So here is your obscure video game trivia for the day. In its history, Electronic Arts has only published one, exactly one, all-text adventure game. And to do so, they partnered up with a New Jersey software company called Cognetics Corporation. Now, Cognetics hadn't really done video games before. Aside from the game that we're about to talk about, they really only have one other claim to fame. I mean, quite literally, I could only find one other thing on them. Their wiki page is like two sentences. One lists this game, and the other describes a system called HyperTize. So, back in 1983, Ben Schneiderman started a research project at the University of Maryland that was originally called the Electronic Encyclopedia System, or TIES. But unfortunately, that name was trademarked by someone else, so the name was changed to HyperTize, because TIES was, in fact, a hypertext system. So if you've been listening to our podcast for a while. You've heard us talk about hypertext before. We would have talked about it at length, mostly when we talked about the puzzle adventure game called Myst. Now, Myst was originally built on a hypermedia platform, one that was developed by Apple. It was called HyperCard. So hypermedia languages are like the precursors of the modern internet. They are the ability to link to other things within the text of something. So early on, we couldn't click on a word and have it linked to something. That's what a hyperlink, a hypertext is. And hypermedia includes media where you can link to pictures and link to video and basically everything that the modern internet is that y'all are used to started with hypermedia. That's what it is. It's the evolution of hypermedia. And Ties was super early on in the history of hypermedia languages back in 1983. What was special about it, why it's notable in the history of hypertext, is because it was text-based. So it's one of the few hypertext languages that could be used with DOS that was used before there were Windows and graphical interfaces. And for our purposes today, it was eventually sold to the Cognetics Corporation, and it was commercialized as the product called HyperTize. But in the mid-1980s, a little bit after this, as they're working on that, Cognetics was looking to get into video games, and they were in particular interested in the concept of interactive fiction. So at one point, Thomas Dish gets called up by his publisher, and he's asked to consult on an interactive fiction project that Cosmetics was working on. Let's say planning at this point, because working on was not where they were at this point. He was brought in to Cognetics, and he was introduced to, of all things, an Infocom game called Deadline and a text game called Adventure. Now, Adventure, we've talked about countless times before, right? Adventure was Colossal Cave Adventure. That is the beginning of everything. I mean, not quite, but it's close to the beginning. It is one of the most influential games in history. You can trace the influence of Colossal Cave Adventure so far into now. It's not even funny. It is the granddaddy of adventure games. And Adventure just stretched into action, into role-playing. Like, Colossal Cave Adventure is it. We've done a whole episode on it. Go check it out. It has come up. Any early role-playing game, Wizardry, Ultima, Dragon Quest, probably all of them. I mean, everyone from that early time period referenced Colossal Cave Adventure. So, I mean, you'll if you've been through our archives, you've no doubt heard of Adventure before. Deadline, on the other hand, we really didn't talk much about. It was Infocom's third game. It was the first game they ever published that was not a Zork title. And therefore, too, it was also their first mystery game, because Zork wasn't a mystery game. Now, Thomas Dish didn't see much in Adventure. He called it nothing more than a glorified maze problem.
Oh.
Right. But in Deadline, he said that he saw the possibility of a new art form. He walked away from the meeting. He consulted on the project the way he was supposed to. And then he wrote on a single page in his 1983 notebook. He titled it Amnesia, a computer interactive novel. Of course, sometime later, you know, they had gone their separate ways. I don't really know what happened this period. But sometime later, Dish brought that idea, Amnesia, a computer interactive novel, back to the publisher, Harper & Row, and they bought it on the spot, and they put him back in touch with the people at Cognetics. So this was a period, you know, 83, 84, when book publishers were trying to get into video games, into this concept of interactive fiction and otherwise. You know, they were trying to diversify, right? We actually talked about that in the Infocom episode, because at one point Infocom was looking to be purchased by Collins. It's one of the big publishers, and they passed on it. And that ended up being a mistake, because they ended up selling for much less than they would have gotten if they had sold to the book publisher at that deal. So, or maybe that was Activision. It might have been Activision. But anyways, book publishers at this time were looking to get into video games. They were investing into other markets the way they would invest into the movies now, because they do. You know, that's that they, you know, they want to control the IP from top to bottom. But with the video game crash of 1983, many companies were pulling out of that market, including book publishers. Nobody wanted to do anything with video games because, right? So, you know, they had tried for a little bit, and then as they watched all these other companies fall to the wayside, they too decided to get out. So basically, Harper and Row spent a bunch of money to get this project started. They are said to have printed up documentation and packaging, you know, and then just decided to abandon the project. They didn't even want to tell their own people they decided to abandon the project. Supposedly, it was kept a secret from the people at Harper and Row because they thought people would be pissed. So, but the result was that Dish and the team at Cognetix had to find another partner, right? Because they had started work on this game, they were committed to this project, and now they needed money and a partner to finish all the work that they had started, basically. And they managed to sell the idea to none other than Electronic Arts. Electronic Arts was looking to get into interactive fiction, thanks to Infocom's marketing campaign bashing graphical adventures. You know, people were looking for text adventures, and there was money to be had, so EA said, give me money, right? That's what they do. In an interview, Dish had said that Electronic Arts had not yet done any interactive fiction, and when they bought this, they could see that they weren't buying a pig in a poke. Half the work was done. When they bought it, and they had a great deal of enthusiasm for it, he said. It wasn't just speculative enthusiasm, since they could see what they were getting.
I mean, that works out both ways. One way, you only had to pay for half the work. The other way, still, you get to see it and know that it's a good investment instead of just putting money in hoping.
Win-win. Very true. So, Electronic Arts buys, you know, agrees to publish Amnesia, an interactive computer novel. And as Electronic Arts does, they put together a team to support the project, right? And to see the project to completion. At its helm, as a producer, they installed a man that we've been introduced before called Don Daglow. Don Daglow is one of the absolute pioneers of the video game industry. Well, I don't know how many of his games we've covered directly. Among his accomplishments include the creation of Utopia, which is one of the first city-building games, Dungeon, which we've talked about, which is one of the earliest role-playing games, which is, like I said, where we've encountered him before. And he also created the very first simulation baseball game in 1971. Daglow has been in the industry forever. He worked for Electronic Arts forever. He's like one of only three people that have earned like lifetime achievement awards from, there's like two different interactive, you know, like video game, you know, organizations, and only three people have earned lifetime achievements from both of them, and he's one of them. So he's important.
Yeah, I'd definitely say so.
Yeah, I know. So Daglow helps put this team together in order to create Dish's interactive fiction. So I should say, in one interview I found in which Dish was interviewed on Amnesia, he was asked exactly what Amnesia was. Is it an electronic novel? Is it interactive fiction? Or what is it? And he replied, I tried to invent a term for it the way movies did for motion picture, because someday someone will have to invent a term that's less clunky than interactive fiction. My candidate was microfiction. The interview then suggested to Thomas Dish participant stories, but that was shot down by Dish.
Nice.
Participant stories. Interactive fiction did not go away. It's still used to this day. We just call it IF. So.
Oh, did not know that.
All in all, it seemed like Thomas Dish really enjoyed the challenge of writing a video game. There are so many things you can do in a novel that you just can't do here, he mentioned in his interview. Just consider the way in which we read the text of computer fiction. It's a series of stops and starts. You can never build up the narrative momentum that you have in a novel. You have a screen full or two most of prose, and then you have to give the player something to do. You have to keep the sense of participation alive in the player, or else you're just reading a book in which the computer becomes an electronic page turner. Properly done, that means you can never count on the kind of tranced immersion in an imagined story that the novel reader gets. What you have to do instead is create an excitement in the involvement with the player. This requires a whole set of strategies that bear no relation to novel writing. You have to create a single, clear, coherent image, and then also have to be aware of the possibilities of branching and telling not just a single story, but creating an environment in which a story can grow like a houseplant in various directions. All of these are problems that ordinary fiction doesn't have to contend with. And that's interesting because Dish and the team definitely created an environment for players to explore. In fact, now the environment is probably the most unique thing about this game at the time it was published. You see, in Amnesia, you wake up as the player in a Midtown Manhattan hotel room with absolutely no memory. You have no clothes on, you have no money, no memory of what you look like. You wake up in a Midtown Manhattan hotel as a blank slate. You quickly discover that you're engaged to a woman you can't remember. You're trying to be killed by a strange man that you don't know, and the state of Texas is seeking you out for murder.
Wow. Quite the conundrum you found yourself in.
It very much is. But in addition to this whole story playing out, this game simulates life in Manhattan at a time in which city simulations just weren't a thing. Dish and the team modeled every block and every street corner of Manhattan. Over 4,000 separate Manhattan locations, including 650 separate streets, are modeled into the game. You have to move from place to place on foot, and you have to reach specific destinations at specific times of day to advance the plot once you know where to go. Stores actually open and close at their correct time, streetlights turn on, the subway lines run at their correct times. They worked very hard to simulate a breathing city in this mid-1980s text adventure, which is kind of cool.
That is definitely cool, yeah.
I say it's the most interesting thing about it because Amnesia, I mean, no one's heard of Amnesia, let's be fair. It's a game that has kind of fallen into obscurity. And I mean, for good reason, like when you read reviews, you know, it advertised itself as this interesting open adventure, but ended up like being this, like all the complaints about it people have are, you know, cool. I have to be here at a specific time. It's not really a choose your own adventure, is it? Like it's linear, basically. Like no matter how you shake it, it's linear. And that's what people didn't like, is that they felt like they got pigeonholed too much. But what it is, what I feel is really unique about it is that Thomas Dish's Amnesia 1985 Manhattan is not 2024 Manhattan, right? So they accurately modeled the city, and what it provides us now is, it's almost like a digital, like archaeology type deal, to where, like, you can go back 30 years, 40 years, rather. It's 40 years, 85. You can go back 40 years and see what Manhattan was like 40 years ago in digital form. So it's this really unique, like, snippet of what it was like at the time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it definitely does.
And I think that's super cool, honestly. I think that's really cool and one unique and worthy thing about it. So in an interview, Thomas Dish acknowledged that for some people, the major fascination with this game was always going to be this enormously simulated environment. He noted that he looks forward to the day when it will be possible to have memory systems of in our hardware of such a power that he can bring out an expanded version of Amnesia that would create a totally illusionistic sense of New York, in which every street corner has its own unique experience and is tied to the actual reality of the place. And I put this in here, and it's really funny because you already said that Thomas Dish has this way of seeing the future in his novel, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't stop there. So he goes on to say that that's a really huge undertaking, right? That microfictions, like soap operas, will eventually have to be written by teams of writers because the ideal fiction will have so much text that a single writer couldn't produce that much work.
Wow.
Right? Right?
That's crazy.
The interviewer literally asked him to pull out his crystal ball and talk about what's next, and this is what he said. There will be multiplayer interactive fiction games in which you and another player on the same machine or machines hooked together to a mainframe would interact as separate characters just as three or four people can play Monopoly. You could also hook it up to film works via video discs and have graphics. I think that there will be computer networks, like television networks, in which you can interact with an ever-changing story as much as you can now tune into a soap opera.
That's just crazy.
So, bro, like, predicted MMOs before there were MMOs. Like, literally, we were a couple years out from that ever being a thing, you know, because late 80s is when that started to all kind of take fruition. And he's like, yeah, there's going to be persistent online worlds, which is absolutely a thing now, you know?
Definitely.
Crazy. Just crazy. I mean, all in all, Amnesia wasn't that popular. You know, the model of the city was interesting, but like I said, it was a puzzle game that just kind of didn't give you much, like, it just wasn't, it just walked you through it straight through the story. So it ended up being like an interactive novel to a lot of people. You know, it was just a puzzle game, you know, stick this key in this lock. It wasn't anything extravagant. That's okay, though. This was still really, really early on in video games. And of course, we know where video games got to eventually, where he realized it, right? With living, breathing cities. I mean, Grand Theft Auto is literally what he predicted, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you're limited at the time by technology, but you can still, I mean, it's kind of crazy when you think of all these people who've written these dystopian societies that are more and more of what the world is actually becoming. And it makes you wonder, like, is there some pattern that's so obvious for some to see that others are just ignoring?
Well, he saw it. And eventually someone did it, right?
You got that right, Dave. God damn it.
So, you know, your little bit of trivia for today is that if anyone ever asks you what's the only text adventure game, all text, very specifically all text. We know, like, in the mobile era that there were other, like, text-ish type games. But in this genre, early on, in the technical all text adventure, EA only published one, and it is Amnesia. So there's your obscure bit of trivia. I know we're a little shorter than normal, but there's not a lot on this. I really wanted to do it. And I dug for interviews. I found a couple, but there's just not much. Like, Dish did this one random thing, and then he went on to write a lot of stuff, right? You know, we know what EA did, because EA is EA. They took over the world. And then Dish did the Brave Little Toaster after this, so his career carried on until he passed away in 2008. Literally, his last novel was published in 2008. He was writing until the year he passed away.
Wow.
And there are even posthumous stories of his that have been published. So this was a little great detour to a great career, basically. So yeah, a little bit of trivia, a little bit of a Thomas Dish. You got to learn a little bit, another notch on the career of Don Daglow. The only all-text adventure published by EA, Thomas Dish's Amnesia. That's that.
A game that once you play, you forget what you played.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Well, you know, you had to save it.
I know. Well, all in all, there's a lot of other things that were involved in this. You know, you learn about Zork and Infocom and EA and Don Daglow and Adventure and Colossal Cave Adventure. And, you know, there's this game comes at the intersection of a lot of other stories. Some really fascinating stories. I'd suggest checking out the Zork one. That was a fantastic episode. Of course, you can find it by going to the archives on our website, which is www.memorycardlane.com. Rob, what else can people do on our website?
Well, Dave, you can find a calendar of our future episodes. You can find a link to our Patreon where you can help support Dave and I in our podcasting adventure and get access to ad-free and unedited versions of all of our episodes. And you can find a link to our Discord where you can come hang out with Dave and I, talk video games or whatever else, you know, as long as it's a cool conversation, we're down to have it. And also you can find a link to our social medias where I am found on several platforms as Rob_O_Raptor and Dave.
I can be found on various platforms as David is Wrong. Each week we tell you a story about one topic relevant to the current week in gaming history. It could be about a game, console, technology, company, just something. While doing so, we hope to teach you something new about the topic, what it took from the world as its inspiration, or what it gave back to the world in its legacy. Every day when I sit down to research topics and we sit down to pick topics and everything, and we go through what we're going to talk about, we learn things. That's the best part about doing this, is every week we learn something new about video games, and we get to take all the new things that we learn and bring it to you. And that's fantastic. So in celebration and recognition of that fantastic cycle, we like to go round table and talk about what we've learned over the course of this episode. So Rob, what did you learn today?
Well, Dave, obviously, I did not know about Amnesia. If I played it, then I forgot about it. But it's kind of awesome to know that it was kind of still an influential thing nonetheless. And to know that it was written by the same guy who wrote Brave Little Toaster is pretty freaking awesome. You had to know that was coming. But
that's true.
I just think it's really cool. I mean, obviously, I don't know much about the game other than what you explained. And it sounds like a really awesome concept. I believe that it would probably be a fun one if you're into null text adventure kind of game. It's not really my forte, so I don't know that I would ever want to, but I think that based on the story that it gives, it's a very interesting game, and it just goes to show you the creativity that some of these people can have and how you can take a story that you want to have a story of and make it into a game that people still want to play or read.
Right.
So I think it's just a culmination of cool.
Culmination of cool indeed.
So what is your big takeaway of the day, Dave?
I didn't know that Thomas Dish wrote The Brave Little Toaster, so that was a fun little thing to learn. I really don't know Thomas Dish. I know that I which is crazy because sci-fi is a favorite genre of mine. I don't know. I didn't read Dune till a couple years ago, so I guess we all just have things fall through the cracks, you know?
That's very true.
But anyway, this was all new to me. Thomas Dish, Amnesia, EA doing a text adventure. When I found that little bit of obscure trivia, I decided I want to do a whole episode on it, which, you know, sometimes when you do episodes on obscure things, it's hard to stretch them out. I think we did a good job for today. We're going to fall right on a normal time. But it was fun. Learning about, you know, how that all came together was fun. So, All right, Rob. Well, before I take it out of here and look into next week, is there anything that you'd like to add to today's episode?
Well, Dave, as always, I do want to take one quick moment to say thank you so much to all of our listeners. It means the world to us to have you along on this ride, so we thank you for that. So thank you.
Thank you. And so we closed the book on Amnesia, a text adventure that not only tested our memory and wit, but also expanded our understanding of what video games could achieve narratively. Thomas M. Dish's foray into interactive fiction reminds us that the power of words could be just as compelling as the most advanced graphics, inviting us into a world where every typed command could lead to discovery or despair. As we journeyed through the streets of New York City, devoid of memories, we're reminded of a fundamental human quest for identity and understanding. A quest that in many ways mirrors our own experiences in the real world. And so we bid farewell to the intriguing world of Amnesia. But our adventure through the annals of gaming history is far from over. Next week, we'll be turning our attention to a saga that ignited the flames of tactical strategy games and spawned a beloved franchise that endures to this day. Join us next week as we explore the origins of the Fire Emblem series, a cornerstone of the strategy RPG genre that challenges players to think several moves ahead, forging alliances and battling foes in a quest to restore peace to troubled lands. So sharpen your swords and get ready to show us your best tactics as we showcase the strategic brilliance of Fire Emblem on yet another trip down memory card lane. Do the thing.
Do be the mba mba ba mba.